It is 6:34 on a Friday evening in Lansing. I'm Michael Cohen with producer Jesse Wiza. Thank you for joining us. So beyond the implications to our healthcare system, there were some significant legal implications to the Supreme Court's ruling yesterday. To break it all down, I'm joined by Brian Kalt. He's the Harold Norris Faculty Scholar at the MSU College of Law. He specializes in constitutional law. Brian, thank you for joining us on WILS this evening.
Thanks for having me.
So first, did you and others at the MSU College of Law that you spoke to anticipate this court ruling, or was the law's approval a bit of a shocker?
Well, there were a few people who thought that it would be upheld, but I don't think that anyone expected that the court would do it the way it did, with Roberts joining the liberals without Kennedy and using the tax reasoning that he used.
As you know,
the Commerce Clause.
What are the implications of that, the fact that he decided to call the individual mandate a tax? And basically, how did he come to that conclusion, that distinction, and what does it mean for in terms of the precedents it sets?
Well, it was really interesting because it was actually a very conservative ruling. By 5-4, the court ruled that the Commerce Clause does not allow this sort of regulation, and so it's a new limit on the Commerce Clause, on Congress's power. That I mean, the law itself was unprecedented, so it's not that they were restricting what was already there, but it's a new limit. It's a victory for those who say that the federal government has limited powers, and the four liberals in dissent were really unhappy about that. And if not for the tax argument, that would have been the headline, that the court was striking down the law in a way that limited Congress's power. By sort of bending over backwards to say, well, Congress said that it wasn't a tax, but it sort of functions like a tax, and we want to find some way, if we can, to uphold the law, Chief Justice Roberts sort of left the Commerce Clause, the conservative ruling, out there, but without striking down the law and without incurring the wrath of half the country.
I mean, doesn't this open the door, though, to saying that any kind of a mandate is basically a tax, and you can go ahead and move ahead with it?
Well, so what they said was, if you look at this as not ordering you to buy health insurance, but rather giving you a choice between buying health insurance or paying this tax, I guess we have to call it now, that does give Congress some leeway to do things that maybe otherwise it couldn't have done, but there are two important limits there. One is that it has to really function as a tax in some sense. So this one functions as a tax in that it really is geared toward raising some money, right? It's not just to penalize people. And it can't be too high. So it was important for the ruling that the penalty that you pay for not having health insurance is actually quite a bit less than a health insurance policy would cost. So they expect that some people will pay the penalty. You can think of it like cigarette taxes. They tax cigarettes in part because they want people to smoke less, but they know that people are going to choose to do that and pay the tax, and that they're going to raise some money that way. The other limit is that saying that something's a tax might work in court, but saying that it's a tax in Congress, that's, in a lot of cases, political suicide. To say that you're raising taxes makes it very unappealing and a lot harder for them to pass politically.
One analyst indicated that the rejection of the Commerce Clause should be understood as a major blow to Congress's authority to pass a social welfare law. Do you agree with that premise?
I don't think so. I don't think that this stops Congress from doing anything that it's been doing these last 70, 80 years since the New Deal. I think that what it might prevent them from doing is sort of continuing on in this direction, marching forward and doing more sorts of intrusive things like ordering people to do things that politically would have been kind of hard for them to do anyway. And doing it through the tax code, which is what they'd been doing all along, is, I think, a gentler way that's a little easier to do. I think the analogy I would make is the government can't order people to have children. They can't force people to procreate. but they can put all these things in the tax code that make your taxes higher. I have kids, and my taxes are lower as a result, and that's what they're saying that they could do here, and it's not that far of a stretch from what they've been doing all along.
Do you yourself agree with the ruling and the view that this is a tax, or do you think the mandate is an overstep by the court?
Well, looking at this legally, I think it was a bit of a stretch for him to say that what they were doing here was a tax when they so strenuously avoided making it a tax when they were selling it politically. He's got a court to run, right? I'm in the ivory tower. I can look at it from the realm of pure theory, and you know, maybe he was trying to save the court from some criticism. But I think it was. It was a little hard to look at how firmly the court was saying, rather how firmly Congress was saying that this wasn't a tax, and then to say, well, but just we'll save Congress from itself here. We'll assume that they were doing something that they really weren't. The other thing was the Medicaid portion, where they actually did strike down part of it. That was pretty big too. That was a limit on federal power. Previously, what the court has said is Congress can basically do whatever it wants as long as it's willing to spend the money, and they can't force states to do things, but they can persuade them. They say, hey, if you expand Medicaid, we'll give you all this money, we'll help pay for it. What the law said was, if you don't expand Medicaid, you're out of the whole program. And the court said, well, that's too coercive, and you can't do that. And that's something the court's actually never said before. They've never restricted Congress's spending power before like that. They've said in other cases, like when they said, if you don't raise the drinking age in your state, we'll cut off part of your highway funding. They said, well, yeah, that's okay. They allowed that. Mm-hmm. Here they didn't allow it. They said it was too coercive. And that's a big deal, too. And you know, lost in the shuffle of all the liberals celebrating that the law was affirmed is this first time of restricting Congress's power there. And there, actually, it was 7-2, two of the liberal justices joined in that part.
I see. You're saying moving ahead, then, the these types of efforts by Congress to restrict funding based on what a state might be doing, that simply won't be able to move forward.
They won't be able to say, do this the way we want, or else we'll blow a big hole in your state budget.
I see, but it's a matter of interpretation, though, right? In terms of just how extreme the impact of the of that the financial impact would be, though.
Exactly. So with the drinking age case, they said 5% of your highway funding, that's a small part of your budget. That's not coercive. We don't know where the line is, but this doesn't cross it. Here they said all of your federal Medicaid money, that's 10, 20% of your budget. We don't know where the line is, but we know that crosses it. And so we're left with some uncertainty here as to where exactly the line is. But what we do know is that the court means what it says when it says, you can't be too coercive here, federal government. You have to give them a real choice.
I'm talking
not about your money or your life kind of choice.
I see. I'm talking to Brian Cult, the Harold Norris Faculty Scholar at the MSU College of Law. So would you say this is one of the most monumental decisions the court has made, in, let's say, in a generation?
I would say in terms of the political importance, it's right up there with Bush v. Gore. In terms of the effect on constitutional law, right, what I'll be teaching my students the next time around, it's pretty big. It's a landmark case for interpretation of the Commerce Clause, for the taxing power, for the spending power, and then also this notion of how far you should bend over backward to interpret a statute in such a way that even though it's not what Congress exactly said, you can interpret it in such a way to avoid striking it down. That's a principle we call the Ashwander principle after an old case. And that's that whole question of judicial modesty versus versus going out there and saying, you know, if it's wrong, it's wrong, we'll strike it down. That whole question is a very deep question, and this is probably the most interesting case on that on that issue that we've had in a long time. And only one justice really wanted to do it that way, but that was enough.
When it comes to future challenges to this law, are there any aspects of the decision you think could be easily challenged and potentially reversed?
Well, anything is possible with an election coming up, a new president coming in, a lot of the justices are old. We're going to have some new blood on the court. And if President Obama is reelected and Scalia or Kennedy retire, expect to see these limits on the Commerce Clause that the five conservatives put out in this case. Expect to see those reversed. On the other side, if Romney wins and we have Ginsburg retiring or Breyer retiring and some conservatives on the court, expect to see this sort of finesse where Roberts was able to join four liberals here. That'll be a lot more difficult, and you'll probably see more of these restrictions, mm-hmm. Commerce Clause, spending power. You'll see those invigorated and some real limits put on Congress and kept on Congress.
Now, one last thing, about a minute left, but in terms of the this extreme measure of pulling Medicaid funding completely from the state, I mean, had there ever been or has there ever been any threat of that level before from the federal government to states when it comes to their state policies?
Well, technically, Medicaid has always operated that way, where the states don't have to be in Medicaid, but the federal government makes it worth their while. So, you know, everyone opts in, not because they're forced to, but because the offer is a really good one. This is the first time that the states have really challenged something as being that coercive. I'm sure that there are other places in the law where the states have that sort of choice and they haven't wanted to fight it, so they haven't complained about it. But this is a sort of a warning to Congress to be careful and not to set things up that way, to make sure states have a real choice in the future.
Brian Cult, the Harold Norris Faculty Scholar at the MSU College of Law. Brian, thank you for joining us on WYLS this evening.
Well, thank you.
Coming up next, we're going to talk about Generation X. It's pretty likely that you're part of that generation if you're listening to me. My next guest is an author of a book that talks about some of the challenges you're facing. He calls it the Forgotten Generation. We'll find out why. That's next. Michael Cohen, 1320 WYLS.